Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you not listen to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
It's still Thursday night. It's still Top of the Pops. It's still December the 17th, 1987. I'm still Al Needham. There's still Sarah B and David Stubbs. And this is still chart music. Hey up, you pop craze youngsters. We are now into the final part, the final furlong, if you will, of this particular episode of Top of the Pops. And I've got to say, me dogs, it's picked up a bit, hasn't it?
It has a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Non-committal noises, isn't it?
You couldn't really pick down anymore, could it?
It certainly couldn't. Let us cut the chit and the chat and let us plunge headlong into the final part of this episode. Take it away, pop world of 1987.
Here's the highest new entry on the chart this week at number 19 in our LA studio on Top of the Pops, Belinda Carlisle.
Davis just about remembers that the next act is coming at us all the way from a studio in Los Angeles. It's Heaven is a Place on Earth by Belinda Carlisle. Born in Los Angeles in 1958, Belinda Carlisle began her musical career in 1977 as a drummer with the LA punk band Germs under the name of Dottie Danger, although she was forced to leave the group without ever playing live with them after a bout of glandular fever. In 1978, she helped to form the Go-Go's, and by 1980, they supported Madness and the Specials on their US tours, which helped them land a deal with Stiff Records in the UK. But while their debut LP, Beauty and the Beat, got to number one for 6 weeks in the US album charts in 1981, they got nowhere near the UK top 40, with their only placing on their first go-around being Our Lips Are Sealed, which got to number 47 in June of 1982. When the band split up in 1985, Carlisle went solo and had immediate success in the USA, but it wouldn't be until this single came out that she made a dent on the UK chart. This is the lead-off single from her new LP, Heaven on Earth, and it soared 24 places this week from number 43 to number 19. And we're being treated to a recording of her performance on Top of the Pops USA. An hour-long show which has been running on CBS on Friday nights for the past 2 months, features performances from their studio and the BBC one, and is co-hosted by Nia Peoples, a former cast member of Fame who appeared in the video for Raspberry Beret, and Gary Davis, who didn't. We need to talk a bit about Top of the Pops USA, don't we, me ducks? Because there's an episode or two floating about on the internet, and it's massively disconcerting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all wrong. It's all wrong.
I mean, you get the wizard intro, and the set's sort of similar, but it's all in NTSC, so you got that sheen on it. Mm. There's an actual young woman presenting.
Yeah.
The dancers are aerobicized to death, and everything's just massively super professional. And then it wangs back to London, and there's Gary Davis with some gimpy British youths.
Yeah.
Shitty suits and manky ties.
I think from the perspective of a podcast like this, there's too little to kind of get your teeth sunk into, really. It's a bit sort of slick and, and it's just, they've managed to kind of airbrush and deodorise it and plane away all the kind of sort of slightly grotesque idiosyncrasies of the Top of the Pops we know and love.
Yeah. Gary Davis was the regular presenter on the Top of the Pops USA. Oh, that must have caused ructions at Radio 1.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, who else are they going to have? I can't see Mike Smith doing this.
It's such a fun...
And I definitely can't see Simon Bates doing it. Can you imagine American sat at home being fucking assailed by the sight of Simon Bates?
Yeah, it's like they pick the most presentable child to kind of shove out to the front when the important people turn up, you know.
Yes.
But, I mean, I think Gary Davis was like, oh, brilliant, an American career beckons, and then it didn't.
No.
Poor Gary. It's a bit of a shame.
Yeah. Maybe Gary Davis could have possibly carried it off because there's a certain sort of nondescriptness about him. But, you know, Batesy or people like that. I mean, it's like Alan Partridge making it in America. I mean, they'd be too far away. The idea of being thousands of miles away from the nearest motorway service station, I just think they'd find the whole atmosphere alienating. They'd feel lost in it. They'd crave, you know, Twixes and Marmites and things like that. And,
the thing is, like, their shit just wouldn't wash in America, would it? This kind of... The sort of bumbling, foffling, oily British bollocks just would not wash there. It's like, what are you guys doing?
No.
Like, you realize we're on television right now.
Hello.
You realize those cameras are on.
Yes.
I like it. I like this kind of. It is weird. There is a sort of uncanny valley vibe about it, where it's like, oh my god, it's like looking into a parallel universe where Top of the Pops isn't the kind of. The kind of adorable shambles that we all know and love. But it's kind of a breath of fresh air for me because, you know, it's just the sort of British shambling. Oh, after a while I just go, for fuck's sake, I just need a dose of cold, hard professionalism, you know. It's like, Britishness is so exhausting.
Yeah,
and I say that as a British person. And, of course, Americanness is exhausting as well, but it's like I have, you know, a countryman of each place. You know, I need to ricochet between the two, really. In my soul.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is, like with the British one, you know, it's kind of bristling and snarling with subtext. I mean, you know, just these kind of very snatches in between songs. There's so much you can sense. Whereas I think in America, you Dick Cavett's and people like that, there's no subtext at all. That is just clamped firmly, you know, where we've had a sort of rictus smile and a kind of rictus presentation. You know, that's the big, big difference. I'm sure a la Larry Sanders, there's all kind of shit going on behind the scenes, but behind the scenes it stays.
Obviously, for Top of the Pops, this is win-win-win-win-win, isn't it? Because it's a great opportunity for them to get footage of American acts. And for British acts, you know, there's a very good chance that they'd suddenly be on a big American network on a Friday night. But sadly, it only lasted 26 episodes due to poor ratings.
Americans.
Yeah. I mean, if they'd have done this in the early 80s, probably would have taken off. You know, giving Americans a chance to see Culture Club and Duran Duran and all that kind of stuff, all the stuff they liked. But, you know, by 1987, what can we offer them?
Yeah. And in any case, there's always that sort of deep resentment of British invasions. It's like that moment in Pulp Fiction where he sort of says to the guy, hey, flock of seagulls, you know, and there's like a sort of deep cultural hatred ventilated there for British invasions and whenever we go over there and try and show them how it's done. And so I think there's always that kind of ingrained resentment. It's funny, that weird little catch when, you know, he says, and in our LA studio, it's like, has he temporarily forgotten the location, the city? You know, thinks it might be.
Of all people, Gary Davis forgetting that, because he'd be fucking wanging that round in the canteen. Oh, yeah, you know, my LA studio.
Yeah, you know, is it.
Where I present my show, Top of the Pops USA.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, imagine if Savile was still around and he presented it. Fucking hell.
No, but there is a certain, you know, something that truly reminds you that there is something that is so idiosyncratically British that it evaporates, you know, when it kind of leaves the shores of the UK.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and when we cut to the audience in America, you know, there's definitely no suits in evidence, but they're not wearing much of anything either, really, are they? There's no sense that we're missing out on anything.
No, I mean, this is it. I mean, there's, you know, apart from all the sort of brilliant R&B that's going on and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, you know, producing brilliant singles every half an hour. Yeah, it's a slightly down time.
And of course, I think the worst thing that came over this crossover period was we got to see Kiss perform Crazy Nights, which is, no word of a lie, the worst performance ever on Top of the Pops.
Yep.
They're fucking shit.
Yeah. And also, I think from a British point of view, the idea that this is coming from LA, it's just like, well, come on, you know, get on the bloody plane, come over here, you know. So it's like you're too grand for us.
Yeah, and then they would have been greeted by the, huh, what are you doing here?
Yeah,
then?
Exactly.
You've got a massive country over there. What, you're going to come over here and steal the towels out of our hotels, are you, you fuckers? Yeah. We used to own you.
Yeah. They can't win.
But this song, though. I mean, the Go-Go's were massive in America in the early 80s. And over there, she encountered a little bit of a backlash for selling out and being all pop. Mm. But this is pretty much her coming out party in the UK, isn't it? We know no other Belinda Carlisle but this, pretty much. Yeah.
I mean, I know that if Pricey were on, I think he would probably mount some sort of stout and sterling defence for this. But I don't know. I can't muster the sort of sense of irony or kitsch or not even those things, whatever, because he wouldn't do it in that spirit. I mean, you know, and she seems a likable old cove as Belinda Carlisle, but it's just relentlessly atrocious, and it's not even like it's particularly her. It's not even singling out her. It's just I mean, this is interesting. This is about the only remotely guitar based song we have all night, isn't it? I think.
Yes.
Everything else is so it's almost like Top of the Pops has very belatedly caught onto the concept of rockism and the guitar being on the way out, whatever, in the '80s. You know, right. And like, just as actually it's just about to kind of make this kind of great resurgence, because it's this kind of sort of glazed poodle hairish sort of LA sort of processed crap that passes for rock music, you know, that's just lots of sort of like posturing, the sort of, you know, like it's shaving cream ad rock, you know. It's
yes,
and this is what it's been reduced to, and this is what in the future, this is what you
kitty cat. That's living.
That's right. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Or was that? Was it Sound Shop or something like that? Wasn't some sort of like record outlet, a bit like Our Price, and it says time to catch all the bullets from Sound Shop. You know, everything's like that. Do you remember that one? Yeah. Yeah. Oh yes, I think it was called Sound Shop or something like that. Yeah. And it's this histrionic, squawking, ballsless parody of rock.
Yeah, I'm not gonna. I'm sorry, I haven't warmed up. Otherwise, I would do the body fall.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah,
of course, body fall.
Continuing the fine tradition of disagreeing with you on pretty much everything on this episode. I love this song. Well, are you kidding? It's very. I know exactly what it. I know precisely what it is. It's very basic, chug-a-lug, anthemic pop rock. That is kind of it's sort of precision tool to fit a certain dumb hole in your skull. And it's very last song at the disco, very sort of drunk. You can't really dance to it. It's like you have to be sort of drunk to feel feelings about it. It's very or on a hen night or something like that. But it's kind of perfect in itself. It's like it's this solid block of kind of euphoric nonsense. I love it. I mean, Orbital play it in their sets and not in a sort of ironic way because, you know, they're kind of... That is not something to which they stoop. And it's fucking great, and it completely fits in the midst of all this kind of electronic kind of squalling craziness. It's interesting that I haven't seen evidence for this, but apparently this song is featured in Black Mirror and also The Handmaid's Tale. So I find this interesting that there's some producers have seen in it or heard in it the kind of note of dystopian kind of wrongness, and it's because it's the dissonance, isn't it? It's because it's so dumb and happy that's why, you know, because that's going to sound great over images of, you know, people being weirdly estranged from each other because of technology or whatever. But yeah, there's also, I really respect the fact that there's this kind of, because I love a key change, as regular listeners will know, but this one is really rude and abrupt. It's just like, fuck you, this is the key change, USA, USA. And I'm okay with it. Every time, you know, whenever I hear this, I wouldn't put it on. Do you know what I mean? But there's so much music that I wouldn't put on. I wouldn't choose to, you know, I wouldn't reverently take down the vinyl and kind of, you know, and blow it off. But I'd, you know, if this comes on in a cab, I will, you know, I'll feel a surge of
punch the roof in,
which is where it will come on.
Yeah, it's fucking great. She's such an adorable presence as well. Like when she was in the Go-Go's, she had that very. I love how the Go-Go's sound exactly like their name. It's always really pleasing when somebody there's a sort of very all American thing, but with a slight undercurrent of something a bit more spiky, you know. And she just looks very, very wholesome and sweet, and she's got that sort of Priscilla Presley thing about her. and which apparently, according to an extremely oleaginous Neil McCormick review from this year, she's 61 now and seems to just be overjoyed to be performing. She's always sort of skipping about and grinning like a little girl, which is very endearing. And I think this whole performance is very, like I said, it's such a kind of the whiplash that you get from seeing something like the Pogues, you know, and then this, which is so all the guitar, you know, there's several, probably more guitarists than there are guitar parts, and they've all got the stance and they're all doing, you know, and the drummer has like three different mullets kind of stacked on top of each other like pancakes. And it's just like, oh, look, the Americans have turned up. Yeah. And I'm not saying that that's better than the Pogues. Of course it isn't. But it's just there's a delight in the contrast of that complete other end of things, you know. She's got a little black suit on with massive shoulder pads. Obviously, it's 1987. Yes. And a big sort of cabbagey buttonhole.
So even Belinda's got a suit on as well.
Belinda got a suit on. She's flipping her hair. She's doing the hair flip back and forth with her lovely brandy snap hair. Yeah, she's dressed like a secretary at a wedding. And little heels. Yeah, she's got a suit on. She's, you know, she's on brand. And of course she sings like, you know,
she looks better in it than
everyone else. Obviously, as I'm sure Neil McCormick agreed at great length, but I didn't read the whole thing because you know how when things fade out when you've on the Telegraph and you haven't paid for it, it's like, I'm not paying to listen to Neil McCormick ooze about Belinda Carlisle and how she doesn't look any different to how she did when she was 19, you know. But yeah, I mean, she does sing. She's got that very distinctive, slightly annoying voice that she does. It's kind of like a sexy goat sitting on an old washing machine. But again, I'm fine with it. I don't know. I'm just, I give up trying to break down why it is that I'm okay with things. I just am, okay? Let me live.
I think all of those observations are correct, actually. It's just that when I hear it, it makes me sad and angry.
Of course they are.
And, you know, I think it's shy and all that. But I think actually all those observations. Interesting thing about the suit, actually, we talked a lot about the suit, is that we're in this kind of pre-Ladison, pre-loaded era, actually. And it's women, you know, like Belinda Carlisle is clearly very beautiful or whatever, but there's no sense in which, you know, the way that she dresses, you know, in the kind of suit, it sort of defies, you know, objectification or whatever. I'm sure that Annie Lennox, whatever, was doing the same sort of thing at the same time. So, you know, I would at least say that.
Dotty Danger's a fucking shit punk name, though, isn't it? That's proper Quincy punk. It's what Beryl the Peril would have called herself one week in 1977.
Definitely.
Oh, bless her.
And her dad gives her the slipper with a safety pin through it at the end.
God, that was weird, isn't it? King Cotton at the Beano and whatever, and Wizard and Chips, where little 8-year-old girls were given the slipper at the end. Belinda Carlisle isn't Australian, is she?
No.
No.
I've laboured
for
long sections of my life, assuming that she was Australian. I think it's because she once met Andrew Muller, who wrote for Melody Maker, and he's Australian.
What? And it just rubbed off on her.
I mean, you know, it's possible that on that basis alone, I'm disqualified from expressing any kind of authority on Belinda Carlisle. But I just thought she was Australian for some reason.
Have you got any Australian in you?
Anyway, you know, obviously I'm fully disabused of that now. But I mean, obviously this is the LAification of rock music. It's like Sunset stripped of all of its kind of sort of raucousness and all that.
Nice.
Quite nice, though, wasn't it? See,
did you have that one written down?
Yeah. Basically already the forces were mustering to kind of rid the world of this scourge, you know, and the early stirrings of grunge and what have you, because, you know, they were really in revolt against the whole kind of poodle hair tendency of, you know, whether it's Bon Jovi or whatever, etc. You know, that's what they came to drive out.
Or New Order in That One Picture.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So the following week, Heaven Is a Place on Earth jumped 11 places to number 8, and 3 weeks later, it deposed this week's number 1, spending 2 weeks there before being usurped by I Think We're Alone Now by Tiffany, which was fucking weird because she looks like Belinda Carlisle's niece. The follow-up, I Get Weak, got to number 10 in March of 1988, and she'd have 3 more top 10 hits in the 90s and be a chart regular all the way up to 1997. I think this is the biggest achievement of Top of the Pops USA, isn't it? It gave us Belinda Carlisle at number one.
She just won't stop calling me. I said, Belinda, it's over, I said.
I wish you'd call me sometime. Tell you what we'll do right now is have a look at this week's top 10.
Number 10 is Jelly Bean with Elisa Fiorillo and Who Found Who. Madonna goes up 6 to 9 with A Look of Love. The Pogues and Kirsty MacColl, The Great Fairy Tale of New York, up from 19 to 8. And at 7, What Do You Want to Make Those Eyes at Me For from Shaky. Mel and Kim, a rise for them to number 6 with their Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree. And to Power's former number 1, China in Your Hand, is this week's 5. Up 5 to number 4 goes Alison Moyer with her version of Love Letters. And Michael Jackson, The Way You Make Me Feel, stands still at number 3. Standing still at 2, Rick Astley and When I Fall in Love.
So that means we have a brand new number one, and what a year it's been for this band. They were number one earlier in the year with a song called It's a Sin.
And now with Always On My Mind, Chris Lowe and Neil Tennant, the Pet Shop Boys, are back there again at the top. Woo!
Reed fantasizes that Belinda Carlisle is stalking him. Blue Tulip Belinda Carlisle, if you will. While Davis wishes that she or anybody else from the American Top of the Pops would just give him a call before they go into the top 10. They end up at the very top of the pile with Always On My Mind by the Pet Shop Boys. Formed in a hi-fi shop in Chelsea when Neil Tennant, who was working on assorted TV tie-in books for ITV, bought a Korg, and Chris Lowe, who was in a work placement with an architectural firm and had just designed a staircase for an industrial estate in Milton Keynes, said it was dead nice. The Pet Shop Boys took their title from a nickname they had given to some mutual friends who were working in a live domesticated animal emporium, and apparently not from some American lads who were shoving hamsters up their ring pieces. When Tennant landed a job on Smash Hits and was required to travel to New York to interview Sting, he took the opportunity to look up the high-energy producer Bobby Orlando and convinced him to produce the duo, who then spent 1983 and 1984 working up a demo tape which contained West End Girls, which became a US club hit but was only available on import 12-inch over here. After finally getting out of their deal with Bobby O, which involved signing off $1 million worth of future royalties, they took on Tom Watkins as their manager and signed to Parlophone. Their debut single, Opportunities, Let's Make Lots of Money, only got to number 116 in the summer of 1985, but the follow-up, a re-recording of West End Girls, got to number 2 for 2 weeks in January of 1986, and they rapidly became one of the most successful British groups of the late 80s. This is the follow-up to What Have I Done to Deserve This?, the collaboration with Dusty Springfield, which got to number 2 for 2 weeks in August of this year. In the same month, they pitched up to the Central TV studios in Nottingham to take part in Love Me Tender, a 2-hour tribute to Elvis to mark the 10th anniversary of his death. And they covered this song, which was originally recorded by BJ Thomas in 1970 and then covered by Brenda Lee and Gwen McRae in 1972 until it was claimed by Elvis later that year, who took it to number 9 in the UK in January of 1973. Their performance on the show went down so well there was a clamour for its release. It was the second highest new entry last week at number 4, and this week it's leapfrogged When I Fall in Love by Rick Astley and taken China in Your Hand by Tapao down from the top spot. And here they are in the studio. Mission accomplished, Agent King Cole. Yes.
Thank you for your service.
That Love Me Tender special, that was fucking weird, that was.
It's amazing! I had a look at a few performances, including Meatloaf doing Jailhouse Rock.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. God bless Meatloaf. Honestly, because you know that he cares. He cares so much and he gives it loads and then some more. It's just, oh, it's... I once cruelly described him as Mick Jagger in a walrus, and I am going to repent on that, but not yet.
No,
and
no,
why not? You know, I'm going to feel really bad when he dies. I'm going to feel so bad.
I mean, it was a some star cast for this special. I mean, you had Mystery Train, Lordy Miss Claudie, and Hound Dog, sung by Roger Daltrey. Oof. Blue Moon of Kentucky, Good Rocking Tonight, and Paralyzed, Dave Edmonds. Mm. One Night with You and Big Hunk of Love, Kim Wilde. Mm. Heartbreak Hotel and Loving You by Kiki D. Mm. A Mess of the Blues, Love Letters, My Baby Left Me, Elkie Brooks and All Her Looks. Mm-hmm. Suspicious Minds and Money Honey by Benny King. Mm. Hard-Headed Woman, Jailhouse Rock and American Trilogy by Meatloaf. And Are You Lonesome Tonight and Teddy Bear by Boy George. There was a lot of on-stage performances, apart from Kim Wilde, who was rolling about on a bed for One Night With You. But the Pet Shop Boys, they did a video, and it involved a lot of trains, and it involved them dressed up in a lot of leather with caps. It was like, you know, Neil and Chris of Finland, if you will.
it's a camp. I feel like it's a lost camp classic. This entire glorious fiasco.
But Shaky doesn't get a look in.
Yeah,
Shaky.
Yeah, he didn't get a look in, does he? I mean, that's a real snub, isn't it?
Yeah, that's not that wouldn't have worked. How would that?
Oh, maybe Shaky turned down Elvis. You know,
his Elvis should be covering me.
It's never been released on DVD or anything, so it's just that there's a but nothing is on YouTube. It's been ripped off of VHS.
Yeah, bits and bobs. Yeah,
it's great. I was surprised actually at how happy it made me. Yeah.
Did a bit of research and on an Elvis forum, somebody called Andy said, "I remember it well. I was there. It was filmed at the Central TV Studios, Lenton Lane in Nottingham, where Bullseye was filmed, of course. Nottingham, Cradle of Pop. Yeah. I remember Meatloaf never finished American Trilogy. It had to be spliced. Dr. Robert from the Blow Monkeys did follow that dweem, or at least that's how he pronounced it, and walked off to complete silence. No surprise there. Kim Wilde was amazing, and I spent a little while talking to her in the corridor outside her dressing room as the heat in the TV studio was incredible, and I had to get a drink, but oh dear. Boy George was disgusting, playing with himself on the stage before the camera rolled. Ooh. Oh, George. Yeah. And Boy George turns up on that as Sue Pollard, doesn't he? He's got these massive glasses on and some blonde wig going on.
It all
on.
Comes back to Nottingham, doesn't it, somehow?
It does. And also, it looked like Carl Perkins' rug had died 10 years previously as well. But, yeah, I mean, the Pet Shop Boys on that, they were just like Earth, Wind & Fire on the film version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They were the only ones who took an old song and dipped it in fresh new colours.
I mean, as a writer at the time, I remember I did give Pet Shop Boys quite a hard time, really. You know, as you said earlier, not the Young Gods, etc., etc. But I just kind of felt that they were sort of pop ironists who'd arrived a few years too late to the game, and I just found their sort of archness, you know, slightly kind of grating. But now, as I approach middle age, I'm beginning to, you know, I can recognise retrospectively their merits, definitely. Mm. I mean, what you've got with Neil and Chris is not so much yin and yang. I mean, a lot of these kind of duos were yin and yang, weren't they? Like in Sparks, whatever, or Suicide, Soft Cell, and all that. And here you've just got yin and yin, haven't you? Because they're both, you know, pretty much in that kind of sort of deadpan demeanour. And it's strange, you know, it's almost like there's something Smiths-esque about them as well, in the way that they're kind of, you know, they're sort of more distant delivery in the context of things like Top of the Pops. But doing it in the kind of, in the idiom of the time, in the sort of dance idiom of the era or whatever, so they're sort of dead central from that point of view.
Yeah.
So that I like. At the time, I would probably have disdained it, but no, retrospectively, I can see it was a good thing.
I fucking hated this when it came out because we were in Elvis' house and it was my mum and dad's song. Yeah, my dad was a lorry driver right through the 70s.
Yeah.
So I didn't see a lot of him and he didn't see a lot of me mum. Mm. And he was a really quiet bloke as well. And, you know, it was just their song, you know. And it got played at his funeral as well, along with The Wonder of You. I was a bit upset about that. I think they should have knocked out The Wonder of You and put in Tutti Frutti, which was my dad's favourite song ever. Yeah, so when this came out, it was like, oh, fuck, how dare you? I mean, I was no Elvis fan by 1987, but it's like, how the fuck dare you?
Yeah.
But now, like you, David, I look back on it and go, no, this is all right, this is a worthy number one.
Yeah, I can see they brought that shit into your parlour room, haven't they? I didn't see it looking like that.
Yeah, that's I would understand that is difficult when I think everybody's got a song that is sacred to them. And it's like where any fucker covers it, it's just like, fuck you, get out of my house. So I totally understand that. I'm pretty sure that I heard this before I ever heard the original.
Right.
This would have been the first time I heard this song. And I probably thought it was, you know, at this time I probably thought it was theirs. But I mean, I love it. I mean, I love the Pet Shop Boys, always have done. I never found them arch. I never found them aloof. I've found them very warm and very practiced and sort of, but without ever being stiff and without ever being removed in that way or having any sort of
deep down warm. Yeah.
It is kind of startling, like how compressed it is. It is like a toasted sandwich of, you know, like when you get a massive bulging sandwich and then you iron it in a Breville and it's like, how the hell has all of that gone so flat, but, you know, but perfectly, you know, it's done so well. It's kind of this sort of steamrolled horn section. But it's great. It's this very sort of melancholy, wistful, big tune. And they've turned it into a kind of pounding disco lament.
Yeah.
And it's a really good performance. It's kind of surprisingly good. I know I always talk about whether people seem comfortable or uncomfortable, but Neil is you know, incredibly comfortable. He's acting out the song without it being cringy whatsoever. You know, he's looking directly down the camera, which, you know, obviously is a hard thing to pull off. But he's smouldering down the camera, and I was like, I never thought of. He's so unassuming that it's almost a little bit. It's almost a bit odd, but you know, I never realized he's got actually Neil. Lovely eyes you got there. He's kind of given it. You know, he's really working it, and I was like, How interesting. I don't remember him being this much of a pop star in this way, you know. There's all these little rueful expressions and kind of sighing and sort of shaking his head and then doing a little smirk and kind of falling out of character and going back into it again. And, you know, at one point he bops himself in the head, like, oh, little things I should have said and done, bop, with the heel of his hand. And it's just really charming. Yeah. And of course Chris there behind him, just, you know, in a bobble hat and a sweater, just kind of doing what he does. I mean, it's funny, like he's kind of like Gromit out of Wallace and Gromit, isn't he? He's just very sturdy and reliable and totally deadpan.
Covering Elvis songs, this was beginning to, you know, people were beginning to approach Elvis songs by this time. We were only a couple of years removed from Suspicious Minds by Fine Young Cannibals. But does having this song sung by a gay man in 1987 do anything to it?
He's gay? Does it?
Australian as well.
That's the thing, is that I think at this point it would still be a sort of quietly, very subtly subversive thing. Without it being disrespectful, it's not kind of, you know, turning over the tables and smashing shit up. It's just like, but it's like Boy George doing Teddy Bear and Are You Lonesome Tonight. So Boy George on this thing wandering around a kind of the staging of this, sorry, just to go back to the 1987 Elvis special thing. The staging of it was amazing. It was really weird. It was so he's in like a diner and there's loads of kind of extras standing around as if they're dancing, but they've sort of frozen. And it's kind of, and he's wandering around doing the spoken bit and kind of walking right up to them. And it's,
they're all scared rages. Like, oh, fucking Boy George is on drugs.
Oh no. Oh my God. You know, also look at him. Is he a man? Is he a woman? I'm so confused.
This is super lot.
But yeah, I mean, he's there. He's got like 12 inches of makeup on his face as he would at that time and kind of red lippy on his teeth. And he looks kind of a fright, but he sounds beautiful. And he's got these great sad eyes and he's taking it really seriously. I don't think it's a kind of disrespectful thing. Like, yeah, we're going to take this very, very heterosexual thing and claim it for the gays. But I think, it's good. It can only be a good thing, right?
Well, because the thing is, around about this time, any song sung by a gay man that isn't totally 100% happy, you know, people go, oh, it must be about AIDS or something like that.
I mean, that's weird, that, actually, because obviously AIDS was uppermost in people's minds in 1987. Mm. It really, really was coming through as a kind of, you know, major issue that people were trying to engage with, this kind of level. And yet I don't recall anybody actually making that particular connection. I mean, I may not have been paying enough attention, but I just think of it as a sort of standalone, an appropriation of a kind of rock standard and giving it the full sort of high-energy treatment. But, you know, creating something that is, I would definitely acknowledge, is actually immaculate.
Hello there.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Quickly, we haven't got long. Please listen to the all-new Angelos and Barry podcast.
It's a funny one.
Oh, my God, it's hilarious. There's so much muck in it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So Neil Tennant's in a suit, because it's 1987. Chris Lowe, though, I mean, he looks like he's been parachuted in from 1998, doesn't he? He's got a baggy sweatshirt on with a toy robot on it and, a Benny hat with Posh Boy on the front.
But I've always thought of him as very, very style-conscious, Chris Lowe, and I think he would basically definitely made, and he would have understood the cliche, the trope that with the suit was becoming, and said, I'm not having that, and, you know, get me the bobble hat. I'm going to give the dialectical wheel of style and fashion a big spin and come up with the bobble hat.
Yeah, and his kit, you know, a keyboard setup with a green monitor on the side, that's kind of quaint by 1987, isn't it? It's a bit of a throwback.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah.
We're all conversant with Commodore 64s. You know, we've got colours on them and everything. And he's got a green screen that just spits out the word pet shop.
It's like Amstrad, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, by this time, David, 1987's kind of like the year when people are comfortable with synthesizers now, aren't they?
Absolutely.
They're used for everything.
They're ubiquitous. And that's what I was pointing out earlier. You know, the guitar seems to be completely supplanted in this instrument. Kraftwerk made effectively the last album the year before 1980. You know, I actually mentioned this earlier on, ironically, but Kraftwerk made Electric Cafe in 1986, and probably didn't need any because their work was done. The electrification of pop music was complete. I don't think synthophobia was really something that played on people's minds at this point at all.
Synths had gone from something that made a dead weird noise to something you used instead of session musicians.
Yeah, and that's really make a good point there, actually, that they kind of lose the sort of otherness. If you think of, like, 1972, whatever, Virginia Plain, and then Brian Eno comes in with... You know, there's a real sense of otherness about electronics or something like that, and that's kind of lost by 1987.
Yeah.
The kind of retro monitor kind of speaks to their care about staging and stagecraft, really, because they've now sort of blossomed unbelievably into just one of the greatest live bands. Their shows are, and they're just theatre shows really, but on this huge scale and just wildly inventive, and even their sort of festival shows. I saw them at Festival Number 6 a few years ago, and they've always, you know, that they will always do, you know, the big thing and the kind of it's not to cover over any gaps in the songs, you know, all the arrangements are just blown out into these huge things. And they got, because they were, you know, being in Wales, they got the Welsh male voice choir to do Go West. So at the end, you know, this is kind of the finale, and there's like 30 kind of bewildered Welshmen in their like 60s, 70s, or probably 80s, all singing Go West, which was very jolly.
Have either of you interviewed Neil Tennant?
I never did, no.
I did very briefly. It was just a kind of...
Man, what was that like?
Oh, it was lovely. It was delightful. It was a very brief, so how was the gig type interview, which I think that was in 2000, so it still would have been The Maker. And yeah, they were so sweet.
What was it like interviewing someone who'd already done your job before moving on to being a pop star? That would intimidate the fuck out of me.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me, actually, that, yeah, but now you say that, it's like, yeah.
I think I'd be grateful for it, actually. What? I'd be grateful because I think you know what we need, you know.
Yeah. They understand what it's like to be on the other side. Although people don't always, it's like, you know, every arsehole who honks at a learner driver was once themselves a learner driver. So, you know, people forget these things quite easily. But no, he was absolutely... charming and cool, and I seem to recall already sort of sipping champagne, because that's what you do, you come off stage, you drink champagne, and you know,
of course.
But Chris didn't really say anything, but I've got to say, he is just a beam of sunlight, and he's just he's got this huge grin, he's got like a massive head splitting grin, which is like, because he just makes him look like a different person,
right.
Like you can't believe that face kind of divides itself into that, you know, given that he never smiles on stage, which somehow just makes it even better. Like, I know now what he looks like when he smiles. That made it all worthwhile. So yeah, it was like literally a really quick sort of 3 minutes, 5 minutes or something. I would really have liked to have interviewed them properly, because I think they're intelligent musicians who have a lot to say about things.
So, You Were Always On My Mind would claim the Christmas number one spot, and they'd stay there for 4 weeks in total before giving way to Heaven Is a Place on Earth by Belinda Carlisle. It would be the last non-Christmassy Christmas number one for 3 years, because we got Mistletoe and Wine, Do They Know It's Christmas, and then Saviour's Day.
Ugh.
After knocking back demands to release the LP track King's Cross, a song which predicted the Tube fire in November, for charity, they followed it up with Heart, which got to number one for 3 weeks in April of 1988, which would be their last number one single in the UK. Oh, by the way, the BBC countered that August by broadcasting the Elvis Comeback Special, which unbelievably was the first time it had ever been shown on British television. That's fucking insane, isn't it?
Wow.
It was 68, wasn't it, first came out? Yeah. Well, it was like that with the James Bond films, you know. They weren't... Things like Doctor No, which came out, 1962, whatever it was, that didn't appear on TV until 1974, 75, that sort of time.
Ugh.
Just excellent. Pet Shop Boys, Britain's brand new number one with Always On My Mind, but will they be the Christmas number one?
You can find out by watching Top of the Pops on Christmas Day with Gary and with Mike Smith at 2 o'clock.
Thanks for watching. Have yourself a fantastic Christmas, and we'll leave you with the number nine record this week from Madonna. Good night.
Good night.
Reed and Davis, surrounded by a mass of frothy perms, making them look like they're recreating the Rolling Stones video for It's Only Rock and Roll, but with real human hair instead of foam, ruminate over the possibilities of the Pet Shop Boys being the Christmas number one, shill the Christmas Day special once more, and sign off with The Look of Love by Madonna. We've discussed Madonna so many fucking times on Chart Music, Jesus! And here she is with her 19th single in 3 years. Mm-hmm. It's the follow-up to Causing a Commotion, which got to number four in September of this year, and is her third release from the soundtrack to Who's That Girl, which also featured tracks by Club Nouveau, Coty Munda and Scritti Polite. The film has already been released in the UK and has died on its arse, losing $10 million at the box office. But Madonna doesn't give a toss, because she's raked it back and more in her recent world tour of the same name. So we're being treated to a big long advert for the film with the assistance of her co-star Griffin Dunne and a cougar called Murray. And it's up six places this week, from number 15 to number nine. Mm. Well, yeah. At least she's not wearing a suit, I suppose.
I love Madonna, as well, you know, but don't remember this at all. And it's partly because it's not very memorable. I never saw the film. And I'm a big fan of Desperately Seeking Susan. I think it's great. And the thing is, you can tell even from the clips in this video that, I mean, kind of famously, the thing with Desperately Seeking Susan is that Madonna just kind of played Madonna and it worked. She's just this kind of dirty hustler.
Yes.
Here, I think, it is known that she just really wanted to be taken seriously as an actress, and she tried too hard. And you can see it. She just looks a bit awkward, and it's this sort of kind of zany throwback screwball kind of comedy. And you can see even from these bits that it just doesn't work, and she's not right in it. And I feel kind of bad for Griffin Dunne, who is really good, a really kind of underrated actor who was in American Werewolf in London. He's the guy that buys it quite early on and then comes back and makes a nuisance of himself.
Yeah.
In an alternate universe, you know, he's basically Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise is just some mad bastard who follows Scientology. So you can just see that, you know, money was spent on the wrong things in the wrong ways, and Madonna kind of couldn't quite bring it. Hopefully she's realised by now that she's not really an actress. She's a pop star. She's a great, great pop star. But, you know, not everyone can do all of the things. And I think this proves it. Although, yeah, like I said, it's not like this is even a good song either. But she has an embarrassment of good songs. So, you know, one or two missteps are forgivable.
In the 80s, Madonna's forgettable songs are always the slow ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's weird. It doesn't have a tune, which you need in a pop song, really. This
pop
songs 101. It's kind of striking for dark atmospherics and mood, but it misses that mark. So,
I mean, this film came out 3 months ago and has already disappeared from the cinemas of the UK. I mean, that week you could have gone out to see Crocodile Dundee, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Bigfoot and the Hendersons, The Witches of Eastwick, Santa Claus the Movie, The Rescuers, Dirty Dancing, White Flesh is Weak, and Talk Dirty to Me.
Wow.
So, you know, why don't we have some clips from those films to this music? That'd be good.
Yeah. I think song-wise with this, it's almost like they've taken the same tea bag that they brewed Who's That Girl With and sort of seem to get another cup out of it, basically.
Yes.
I mean, it's very much very sort of... in that respect, but
this is Why's That Girl?
Yeah.
Why's That Girl fucking doing this?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. She really was kind of box office anathema at this time. I mean, there's multiple attempts, especially also when she was with Sean Penn. I agree with Sarah. Desperately Seeking Susan is great.
Box office arsenic.
But yes, box office arse. But then if there was the infamous Shanghai Surprise, with her and Sean Penn. And I'm just looking at one or two of the reviews at the time. The Lexington Herald Leader called it a turkey. Ooh. This film is bad. The acting is terrible. The hackneyed screenplay traffics in stereotype in yuck-yuck jokes. And the point is non-existent.
Ooh.
And then, of course, Who's That Girl, which was from this year in the Schenectady Gazette.
Schenectady.
Okay, thank you. Anyway, the correspondent from the Gazette... felt that Who's That Girl is not simply an awful film, but is positively unbearable. It's a movie without a head or a brain, a picture of such crass stupidity that it can't even make you angry. Instead, it numbs you to death with its moronic platitudes, its pretensions to comedy. It's a vanity project which is so amateurishly produced and conceived that it makes you want to cringe in shame. Ooh. And then, in 1989, there was Bloodhounds of Broadway, which was, I think, based on the short stories of Damon Runyon, which is excellent source material. And it's just a two-word review, shit sandwich. Actually, there's not even that. Actually, it just says, produced on a budget of $4 million, the film grossed less than $44,000 in its limited release.
Good Lord.
So, yeah, it was just difficult. I just think that there was a problem with Madonna is that she had this... I think there's something kind of ruthless about her. And you saw in interviews or whatever, she's almost like lacking a dimension. Mm. And I think it's perhaps that lack of dimensionality that like finds her out when she's, you know, on the old big screen. You know, she just didn't quite have the requisite presence. I mean, in contrast to someone like Cher, you know, who obviously starts out as a pop star. And she was a great actor, you know, and she had this kind of all-round humanity and versatility or what have you, you know, and she's able to kind of make that transition. But despite, you know, and she made quite a few films after this did Madonna, but or appeared in a few, including a James Bond, at which point you think, okay, we've got James Bond needs a reboot, you know, if you're dragging Madonna into it.
And yes.
But she was really, really on the up this year. It's an interesting fact that Madonna in Britain, she made her first appearance in the UK, I think it was about 1983, and she just appears at Camden Palace and she does like a little 20-minute sort of set, you know, it's a showcase. No one knows who she is.
Yeah.
The second time she appears in the UK after that is this year, and it's at Wembley Stadium. You know, she does these, like you say, these massive gigs as part of a sellout tour. I actually reviewed her this year at Roundhay Park in Leeds. And and it was a pretty formidable gig, you know. She was top of the world. I just remember that, unfortunately, my my Leeds kinfolk let themselves down a bit down the front because they started chanting, "Get your tits out for the lads."
No.
And he was like from the stage going, "My what?" You know, genuinely couldn't make out what they were hearing. "My what? Sorry, my what? Tits out for the lads." Oh, God, Leeds represent.
See, should have worn a suit. That'll shut up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They got what they asked for a few years later, though, didn't they?
They did, yes.
Yeah,
they had to pay about 70 quid for it in a bummed up book.
Yeah, she called their fucking bluff, didn't she?
But yeah, Leeds' fault, that is. The sex book is all the fault of
Leeds. Yeah, there's a difference between getting your tits out for the lads and getting your tits out for yourself and make a shitload of money. Make a fucking exhibition of yourself. And no one's better at that than Madonna.
Mm. Yeah, you never got the sense that she was anything in other than complete control of, you know, her own sort of... you know, inverted commas, objectification. Yeah.
So, anyway, this clip, we get to see Madonna kissing posters of Elvis and Marlon Brando in her cell. Then she skips out of prison. Then she hooks up with the bloke in glasses. And then they arse about in the scabbier bits of New York. And then she strokes a cougar. And then she tries to be Marilyn Monroe again. And then she eventually snogs that bloke. I mean, you know, from I've not seen the film, but from this... It does look very much like shaking something wild, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's a good snog, though. It's a decent snog. It's a proper, like, big movie kiss. The actual jaw movement instead of the kind of static lip press shenanigans that you get. And, you know, cougars are good, but that's about the best you can say about it.
Yeah, well,
I looked up the kind of the synopsis of it, and I kind of didn't want to know, actually. Yeah. I love the fact that she's just suddenly the big snog scene is in a sort of jungle, which is clearly like in it's on a roof or something, and there's suddenly, so the cougar is there, we're familiar with the cougar, and then there's suddenly a zebra and there's a kangaroo over there, and what are you people doing? I know it's the 80s, but like, come on.
So the following week, while Madonna was busy getting shot of her biff crazy piss headed husband, The Look of Love dropped 5 places to number 14, making this her worst performing single in the UK since Lucky Star got to number 14 in April of 1984. After pretty much taking 1988 off, the follow-up, Like a Prayer, spent 3 weeks at number one in March of 1989, setting her up for a run of 18 top 10 hits on the bounce into the mid-90s. So what's on telly afterwards? Well, BBC One follows up with EastEnders, where Dot Cotton and her manky sideburned husband end up in court. The obligatory Christmas tragedy this year is Mary's daughter being kidnapped by her dad and ending up in a car crash. Then it's the Tomorrow's World Christmas Quiz, A Question of Sport, the 9 o'clock news, Rough Justice, the criminal court documentary series, and they round off the night with a repeat of the show Jumping and a repeat of the TV version of The Untouchables. BBC Two is 10 minutes into Thinking Aloud, where assorted intellectuals discuss the idea of evil and mull over whether it's obsolete or absolute. Then Patty Caldwell presents Remember Terry, a follow-up to the documentary about Terry Maidler, who died of AIDS earlier this year. Then Jim Hacker has to deal with a French diplomatic gift of a Labrador puppy in Yes, Prime Minister. 40 Minutes looks at assorted Christmas parties. Then it's part four of the documentary series Sharansky, The Making of a Dissident. And they close out the night with Newsnight and The Weather. ITV is running a repeat of Only When I Laugh. Then it's Strike It Lucky with Michael Barrymore. The 1973 TV film Birds of Prey, where David Jansen plays a radio traffic helicopter pilot who gets tangled up with a bank job. News at 10, a regional politics show, and they finish off with the Prince's Trust giving Dreams a Chance, where they suck off Prince Charles for an hour. Channel 4 kick on with North to Nowhere, Quest for the Pole, a documentary about an 800-kilometre race to the North Pole involving Japanese motorcyclists, an elderly skier, an Australian helicopter pilot and an American woman and some Huskies. Then it's the 1970 film The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer, starring Peter Cook and John Cleese, Arthur Lowe and Ronnie Corbett. Then Chasing a Rainbow, the Emmy Award-winning documentary film about Josephine Baker. And they finish off with Kings and Desperate Men, the 1981 film about a Canadian radio talk show host who gets tangled up with a terrorist group, starring Patrick McGoohan and Margaret Trudeau. Telly's not kicking into Christmas yet, is it? Which is
yeah,
good.
Yeah, yeah.
So, me dears, what are we talking about in the playground tomorrow?
All the suits.
Yeah.
just all the suits. It's like, is that what adulthood is going to be? Just suits.
Yeah.
Suits and cover versions.
Yeah.
I think in my instance, in the playground, they've been saying, what are you, a 25-year-old man, doing in this playground, handing out cassettes of the Young Gods?
Yes.
Get out of here. but in the offices of Melody Maker, we wouldn't have watched it, to be honest. We'd be all down the pub, so,
But surely the Pogues, one of your bands on Top of the Pops.
Yeah, I think probably, the Pet Shop Boys would probably have been generally the most favoured item. I don't think, with the Pogues at this time, in this particular single, it has taken on a kind of life of its own. And I think people have come, as I said, they had the chance to sort of contemplate it year after year after year. And of course, this is just its first outing. So it probably wouldn't really have kind of impacted at this particular time.
And what were you buying on Saturday?
Pet Shop Boys.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not buying any of that stuff. I don't actually have to go to record shops. I get it sent for free.
You're
anyway.
Not playing the game properly, David.
If. All right. Sorry, I'm not playing it. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
No.
Honestly.
If I had to, if I'd be given a free voucher and it was like, only redeemable over this weekend, then I guess I would have bought the Pet Shop Boys and then, given it away to someone in exchange of beer.
And what does this episode tell us about December 1987?
Well, for me, it feels like the kind of pop is at the sort of arse end of some really kind of interesting spiky ideas that first came to the fore in the early 80s, all to do with like a sort of white soul, white music's relationship with soul. Mm. Also ideas of like sort of retro style or whatever, like you had with that ABC. They were suited and booted back with Lexicon of Love in 1982. But all of this has become sort of played out, overdetermined, whatever, by this stage, and deadly earnest as well. It's lost yes. all of its sense of irony. The Pet Shop, the only real irony that's left tonight is still resides with Pet Shop Boys and what they're doing there. That's the last gasp of that. But what's happening is that the forces of modernity, they're really sort of, scraping their hooves, and they're, like whether it's house, whether it's hip hop, whether it's grunge or whatever, the 90s are galloping around the corner and they're going to kind of remake pop completely, and all this is just going to be sort of blasted aside, and that's going to be reflected actually at the kind of superstar level. Hip hop is going to go global.
Yes.
House is going to lead to sort of acid and rave or whatever. That's going to remake the whole sort of beatscape completely. Mm. And then, Nirvana and people like that, are going to dominate. All that is already beginning to happen.
Yeah.
But there isn't really much of a hint of the rumbling of it even in this particular episode. If you bought your Melody Maker, though, we're all across it.
Mm. Yeah, it tells us that apparently no one knows it's Christmas, apart from the Pogues.
Yeah.
Oh, and Kim Wilde, sorry.
I look at this now and I think, fucking hell, I was in the prime of my life back there, and this was the best the world could offer me. So, yeah, still angry about it.
There's a certain cynicism and a certain laziness at play, even if the artists themselves aren't necessarily aware of it. There's the kind of... artists don't necessarily express these things themselves, and people can be completely sincere in what they're doing without realizing that they are, tools of the big ugly machine of mediocrity. So, I get it.
Just put out a cover version. That'll do. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of laziness actually.
It's a little bit like what you get now with popular film, where there's the lament of where are the good new stories is kind of growing. You know, it's because people do fall back into kind of, well, let's reboot this and retell that. And, you know, and it's people are getting kind of knackered by it because it's like, why aren't there good new stories? You know?
Yeah. This episode is suited and rebooted, isn't it?
Ooh.
Indeed. Well, things are about to get booted. They're about to get booted up the arse, basically, by what's coming next.
I look at this and I just, you know, unbelievably, I think to myself, fucking hell, no wonder people fell upon the Stone Roses and their ilk a few years later.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know.
No, something needed to happen.
Yeah, it did. It did, definitely. But it was happening from all sides, it was from all fronts, you know, on rock, whatever, you know. But yeah, it's just laziness. I mean, I'm sure that Mick Hucknall would protest, you know, worked very hard on that single, you know, 20, 30, 40 takes, you know, sang my heart out. But that's not the point. It's laziness in terms of the decision-making and laziness in terms of applying myself to the idea of, like, is this necessary? Why are we doing this? You know, what is the point? You know, what point are we trying to make? It's just a complete laziness there.
Mm. No, it's difficult. That's a slippery slope, though. Once you start going, is this artistic endeavour really necessary? Once you start down that, it's not long, depending on what mood you're in, you know, you can just end up going, fuck all this forever. There's no point to any of this. You've got to be careful. You've got to tiptoe around that kind of nihilistic pit, you know.
Well, you do if you're Mick Hucknall.
Merry Christmas, everyone. And that, me ducks, is the end of this episode of Chart Music. All that remains is the usual promotional flange. www.chart-music.co.uk, facebook.com/chartmusicpodcast. Reach us on Twitter, chartmusictotp, money down the G-string, patreon.com/chartmusic. Thank you very much, David Stubbs.
Thank you.
Ta-ra, Sarah B.
God bless us, everyone.
My name's Al Needham, and I am not the young gods.
Chart Music.
This is CBS.
It's Music in Action on Top of the Pops with Debbie Gibson, ABC, Def Leppard, Go West, and many more. The hottest performers are coming home tonight on Top of the Pops.
Michelob, so exceptionally smooth, the night belongs to Michelob. Michelob is sponsoring Top of the Pops.
Friday, Top of the Pops rock legend Paul McCartney, Tiffany, The Alarm, and Roger.
Then a knight in shining armor goes on a murderous rampage.
Two gentlemen are dead of two very bizarre means.
The Night Stalker, Friday on CBS Late Night.
For the past 50 years or so, people have listened to their favorite artists on one of these, often accompanied by that familiar backing group, scratch, fluff, dust, and distortion. Now we can experience the amazing sound of this Philips invention, the CD303 compact disc player. Plugged into any system, it can play your favorite tracks in any order. Skip a track, even repeat a track. The discs are digitally recorded and played back by a laser, so there's no background noise and no distortion. The new generation Philips CD303. Hi-fi for generations to come.
Philips. Sounds like we've done it again.
Wednesday on CBS, The Bangles, Sting, Run DMC, The Judds, John Cougar Mellencamp, Stevie Nicks, Michael McDonald, U2, and more in an all-new holiday special. Santa Claus is rocking the town with Top of the Pops.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year!
A very special Christmas Wednesday.
Kitty Cat Supreme, high in protein.
Kitty Cat.
To satisfy a cat's appetite for life.
High protein kitty cat.
You couldn't have a fitter cat.
Great.